Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage as we travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, 2011 Nobel Laureate in Physics, astrophysicist and Bartlett High School graduate Brian P. Schmidt, hosted by the University of Alaska Anchorage Honors College. His talk entitled The First Stars in the Universe was recorded at UAA on August 25th.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. My name is Ronald Spatz. I am the Dean of the Honors College, and I want to welcome you to UAA and to the 9th Annual Convocation Public Presentation. This year's lecture is titled The First Stars in the Universe by 2011 Nobel Laureate in Physics, Dr. Brian P. Schmidt. Distinguished Professor, Australian Research Council Laureate Fellow, and astrophysicist at the Australian National University Mount Stromlo Observatory and Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. Professor Schmidt was elected to the Royal Society in 2012 and shared both the 2006 Shaw Prize in Astronomy and the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics with Saul Perlmutter and Adam Rice, and providing evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. Dr. H. Frederick Dyla, Executive Director and CEO of the American Institute of Physics, said of the 2011 award, "This year's Nobel Prize in Physics recognizes a startling new revelation in our understanding of the cosmos. This discovery not only helps us understand the evolution of the universe, but also gives us new insights into how it may end." Professor Schmidt is currently leading the SkyMapper Telescope Project and the associated Southern Sky Survey. Professor Schmidt was born on February 24, 1967, in Missoula, Montana, where his father, Dana C. Schmidt, was a fisheries biologist. When he was 13, his family relocated to Anchorage, Alaska, where he attended Bartlett High School and graduated in 1985. He earned his B.S. in physics, B.S. in astronomy from the University of Arizona in 1989. He received his master's in astronomy in 1992, and then his Ph.D. in astronomy in 1993 from Harvard University. Professor Schmidt cares deeply about the importance of educational opportunities to change the world for the better. After he won the Nobel Prize, he donated $100,000 of his prize money to the Australian Academy of Science Primary School Science Program. Both in his adopted country of Australia and here in the U.S., Professor Schmidt is a powerful and passionate advocate to the advance of the quality of teaching and for the priority of adequately funding school systems at all levels. On a lighter note, Professor Schmidt's discoveries may upset those with existential concerns. Just 4 days ago, on his way to Anchorage, he delivered a talk to the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, India. The next day, the New Indian Express ran an article with this headline: "Humans may have to live in an empty universe, Nobel laureate." The article began, "Nobel laureate Professor Brian P. Schmidt said the universe is accelerating into nothingness." He continued, "Creation of space happens more quickly than light can travel through it. Eventually, we will live in an empty universe with no neighbors, but only our super galaxy. Telescopes will lose their use as they will not show anything." What would a student think about this? Woody Allen had an answer in his iconic 1977 film, Annie Hall. He depicted a scene with a young student, Alvy, who stopped doing his homework, the school psychologist and his concerned mother. "Doctor, why are you depressed, Alvy?" Alvy's mother, "It's something he read." Doctor said, "Something he read?" Alvy, "The universe is expanding." "Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart, and that would be the end of everything." Alvy's mother, "What is that your business?" "He stopped doing his homework." What's the point? Alvy says. What has the universe got to do with it? His mother says. You're here in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding. As we welcome Professor Schmidt to the podium, we hope he will reassure our Alaskan students that they should, in fact, do their homework. Please welcome Brian P. Schmidt.
Thank you, Ron. All right, well, I hope my talk lives up to both the introduction and the long prelude that we had. So today I'm going to talk about the first stars in the universe. I'm going to talk about the story of the universe. The story of my Nobel Prize was a talk I gave last year, and I know several people had seen it, so I decided I would talk a little bit different on some of the stuff we're doing now. Now, as Ron said, I'm very passionate about the role that education plays, because it made such a big deal to me, but it also made a big deal to the people I went to school with here. And so I happen to have my English teacher, Kathy Gohl-Sievert, here. And so you're the only person who gave me B's in high school. I got all my B's from her, but I kept taking her class because it was a fantastic English class. And Lord knows I've needed that skill as much as the science I've learned. So I just want to give you, a round of applause. Thank you very much. All right, so first stars in the universe. So I'm going to talk about how we think about the universe is expanding. So let's start. This is really some of the cosmology. So our ability to start understanding the universe came when we developed telescopes. Telescopes that could look at the light of stars. Now we can take pictures of stars, but we can also take what we call spectra of stars, where we spread their light out into the colors of the rainbow. And when we do that, we see a rainbow, but interposed on it, places where light is either absorbed or emitted. And those are a signature of what a star is made out of. It's essentially a fingerprint of color that every atom has. So I can identify if an object is made of helium. That was first detected on the sun. Helium was detected on the sun by its fingerprint before it was detected on Earth. But I can also see uranium. I can see any element you can think of. I can get a fingerprint. So a man, Vesto Melvin Slipher, whose family actually gave me a scholarship to study at the University of Arizona, went through and did this for galaxies. Now, in 1916, when he did this work, we did not know what a galaxy was. And he soon saw that they had a set of fingerprints that looked almost exactly like stars, with one difference. All of the spectral signatures were stretched redward. They were red of where they should be. Now, he knew what this might be from, which is something called the Doppler shift. We all know what the Doppler shift is because we experience in everyday life with sound waves. If you have, for example, a police car, and here I have one from Canberra, a Canberra police car, looks a little different than the ones here, and it's traveling relative to how fast sound can travel. And so you can see as it travels, it moves this direction, and so the sound waves get compressed this side, and they get stretched this side. So when this police car is coming towards you, its pitch is changed. It's higher because the sound waves are compressed. When it goes past you, well, then you see it from this side, and the sound waves are stretched and lowered. Light is a wave. And so the same thing applies to light waves, except for when you compress light waves, you make things bluer, and when you stretch light waves, you make them redder. This turns out not to be the reason why a BMW, when it comes towards you, has blue headlights. You need to be moving very, very quickly for such an effect. Thousands of kilometers or miles per second. So what Slipher figured out is when he looked at all these galaxies and their light was all stretched redward, that all of these galaxies were moving away from us. And we're not just talking slow, we're talking at thousands of miles per second. a fraction of the speed of light. So that was an enigma in 1916. And it was solved by Edwin Hubble by measuring distances. Now, Hubble used the fact that when you look at an object, it appears fainter the further away it is. So if you could look at a star in a galaxy and look at a star in another galaxy, the brighter star would correspond to the nearby galaxy. Now, the stars have to be roughly the same brightness, and it turns out they were to a factor of 10. Doesn't sound very good, but we're astronomers. We're desperate. We do what we can. And so in 1929, using the largest telescope on the planet, the 100-inch, which you can still visit just outside of Los Angeles and Mount Wilson, he went through and looked at the stars in Slipher's galaxies. And what he saw was that the further the galaxy was away by how bright the stars were, so the fainter the stars, that means the further the galaxy, the faster it was moving away. And in 1929, he announced to the world that that meant that the universe was expanding. So to understand why he said that, let's make a little movie of the universe. I have a movie of the universe, which through the wonders of my computer, I'm going to expand. So I've done that. Now I'm going to have before and after overlaid. So what do I see? Nearby objects, as I've expanded the universe, they've moved a little bit. The distant objects, they've moved a lot. If I were measuring their velocity, the radar gun or something, the nearby ones would be moving a little bit, the distant ones would be moving quickly. The further away you are in an expanding universe, the faster you appear to be moving. And so we have a theory from Einstein, the theory of general relativity, of which this turns out to be a natural outcome. So we think we even understand it from the physics that we can test. But the consequences of this are quite profound, because everyone in the universe sees the same thing. Not like we're a special place in the universe. This is true of anyone in the universe. But if the universe is expanding, we can run it in reverse. And what does that mean? Things get closer, closer, and you're inevitably brought to the idea of the Big Bang, the time when everything in the universe is on top of everything else. So if the universe is expanding now, run it back in time, and everything in the universe gets closer and closer and closer. And that turns out to cause things to change as we look back in time. It kind of means that we had a beginning when everything was on top of everything else, the Big Bang. Almost inevitable in a universe which is expanding. So what happens when we compress things? We're going to do a little experiment here. And I have someone in the UK whose accent I will spare you. And he has a piston. The piston is a piece of glass. And he has this little thing he's going to push down and compress the air. He's also put in a little piece of cotton, which he's just put at the bottom. Let's see what happens. So, no fancy, boom. Caught on fire, burned. Why? Because when you compress things in physics, you make them hotter. So the universe right now turns out to be, I can't even put it in Fahrenheit because I don't remember the number, but it's minus 270 degrees Celsius. It's very cold, even compared to Alaska. But in the past, when the universe was smaller, it was hotter. And I can go back, and I can literally, if I look closer and closer to the time of the Big Bang, I can dial any temperature I want into the universe. I can make it hotter than the sun. I can make it as hot as what we do in the Large Hadron Collider when we make the biggest, hottest thing we can on Earth. And I can make it even hotter than that. At some point, the laws of physics, as we know, probably break down. But we don't quite know when that is, because there's limits to how far we can test things. If I go back, now let's learn a little bit of particle physics. This is something most of us will probably not know too much about. These are all the particles that we know of in the universe. You will see there's a new one, the Higgs that was discovered last year. And these are the elementary particles. Now you will note there are no protons or neutrons up there. And that's because protons and neutrons are not elementary particles. They're made up of other particles. They're made up of quarks, it turns out. Now that's actually only half the story up there, because for every particle, there is an antiparticle, antimatter. And the universe is constructed this way. I don't know why, it's just the way it is. And some objects, you will see, some objects have antiparticles and some don't. The ones that don't, turns out that the particle is itself its antiparticle. Light, a photon, is its own antiparticle. And so light can do funny things and turn into things or destroy itself under certain circumstances. So one of the things that can happen is, as the universe becomes smaller and smaller, hotter and hotter, the light turns in first to ultraviolet, then it turns into X-rays, and I can dial it back up to gamma rays, to any type of light you want. So more energetic forms of light. And at some point, I can make the energy contained in a single piece of light higher than E equals mc squared, Einstein's very famous equation, where the mass, m, is the mass of an electron. At that point, when it becomes, for example, twice the mass of the electron, suddenly that piece of light can turn into an electron and its antimatter particle, a positron. It doesn't do it for very long. Those things often collide back and make another piece of light. But you can have this transformation happening. It's called quantum fluctuations. And so in the early universe, when things were really hot, light is literally turning into things. And I can make even heavier things. I can make, for example, protons and antiprotons. Now, they're, of course, made up of these other things, but those can be made and destroyed in time. So if I go back to when the universe was a few microseconds old, the universe was literally full of light, but it was full of electrons being created and protons being created and neutrons being created and everything else you can think of. But the universe cools down. It's very young. And as the universe cools down, at this point, you can literally make all these things in and out of each other just by the heat and energy in the early universe. But when the universe gets to on order of a second old, things change. At some point, you get to the point where the light is no longer able to make, for example, protons out of, you know, the energy itself, because the energy of light is below the mass of the proton c squared. Now, the mass of the proton is 1,836 times larger than an electron, so it happens earlier for protons than for electrons. But eventually, when you get down to this temperature, it turns out you can't produce electrons, and you can't do the reaction of electrons plus protons making neutrons. Now, many of you will not be aware, but a neutron is effectively radioactive. If you stick it in a nucleus with another proton and make an atom, then it's not. It's stable. But on its own, a neutron, on average 887 seconds, there's a 50-50 chance that it will radioactively decay into a proton and electron, effectively. So those neutrons, as the universe is cooling down, that are left, are radioactively decaying. But as the universe cools, it ends up being the same temperature as the center of the sun. And the center of the sun is a giant nuclear reactor. And so you can do an interesting thing. You can take together protons and neutrons before they radioactively decay and make deuterium. That is the first element. It's a form of hydrogen that has an extra neutron, often referred to as heavy hydrogen, or if you hear of heavy water in, for example, World War II movies, that is a hydrogen with an extra neutron. So it has twice the mass of hydrogen normally has. And deuterium, it turns out to be the most essentially unstable thing in the universe for making nuclear reactions. So if you want to make yourself a hydrogen bomb, you're typically going to make it out of this, not out of normal hydrogen. And the reason is that you can take hydrogen or deuterium plus deuterium, and you can make helium. So in this nuclear reactor in the earliest part of the universe, You will literally take the protons and neutrons, the electrons are off on their own, not doing anything, and you can build up a bunch of helium. And when you do the full calculation, you find out, using the laws of physics that we know very, very well, thanks to World War II and the ensuing Cold War, that the universe's nuclear reactor should have produced 3 parts hydrogen to 1 part helium with trace amounts of deuterium and lithium. Now, people like me go out and look at the universe. Now, this is not work I have done specifically. And when we go out and we measure the universe, it's 3 parts hydrogen, 1 part helium, 1 part in 100,000 deuterium, just like it's supposed to be, and 1 part in 10 billion lithium, just like we think it's supposed to be. This is one of the reasons we believe in the Big Bang, is because it predicts exactly what the universe should be made out of. You will note that the carbon and stuff that we're made out of is not listed there. It has been made in subsequently, and I'll talk about that in a second. So we have a universe that is made out of these things. The universe cools off. No more nuclear reactions can happen, because it turns out if you want to take helium and make carbon out of it, you need a hot, dense universe. But the universe has already cooled off now not to be so hot and not to be so dense. So it can start making things, and then it sort of fizzles. The nuclear reactor fizzles. Now, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, what you really get when you do a physical calculation is how old the universe is. So that's 1 second, 10 seconds, 100 seconds, 1,000 seconds. And you sort of get the nuclear reaction, and you get all these numbers of how much stuff there should be. And it all more or less fits the observations. So then the universe continues to cool. And eventually, 380,000 years later, it looks like this. Now, 380,000 years is a long time for us, but you know, for the scale of the universe, it's not that long. What we see here, it turns out, are sound waves. For reasons that we think have to do with quantum mechanics, the universe was born like there was a spray of gravel thrown across a pond, and you're seeing all these essentially waves bouncing back and forth through the universe. So it's sort of like ripples traveling through a pond, except for the universe is, of course, 3 dimensions. And so those ripples are going throughout space. And we think it was essentially the Big Bang that created these ripples. And so you see in the universe are these ripples. And we have a very good understanding about these ripples. And they allow us to do many things that I'm not going to talk too much about today. So why do we see this picture right now? It's because the universe made a big change when it was 380,000 years old. It went from being opaque, can't see through it, to being transparent. And the reason that happened is because of the way photons travel through the universe. Now, when you look at a proton and an electron, the proton, I've already told you, is 1,836 times bigger than the electron. So you might think, if you're a photon, that that's what a proton and electron are going to look like to you. But it's not true. It turns out that the electron looks like that if you're a photon. It's this great big baseball bat that you always run into. Now, when the universe is hot, that means the atoms of the universe are moving quickly. So when an electron and a proton get together to make a complete hydrogen atom, they bump into another one because it's still dense, and the motions caused by the heat are sufficient to knock the electron off the hydrogen atom. And so the universe is what we say is ionized. The electrons are separated from their protons. And so the universe is really this opaque fog. It's full of electrons. So that's what the universe looks like if you're trying to travel through it as a piece of light. You just bounce from electron to electron to electron. Suddenly, the universe cools to about 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit. At 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit, it's a little cooler than the sun. And the motions of when an electron and a proton get together are no longer sufficient to knock the electron off. And so all of the electrons suddenly get bound to a proton, and then they look tiny again to a photon. The universe goes from being full with fog to suddenly being crystal clear, sort of like Anchorage 2 days ago. And so you can imagine you're a photon. You've been traveling since the beginning of time. You've been banging away. And then, yee-haw! You travel for 13.8 billion years until you have the misfortune to run into some stupid telescope that's out orbiting the Earth, and you're captured. That is a picture we see of the fog being lifted on up on the universe. It's another thing that's predicted by the Big Bang, and we see it. Everywhere we look, in all directions, this fog, this picture of the universe is there, with the sound waves that we think we understand. All right, so now what happens? Well, the universe continues to cool, and remember, we've lost the fog. The universe is these tiny little ripples, which are one part in 100,000. And this is a pretty accurate picture. Whoops, not supposed to see that yet. This is a pretty accurate picture of the universe when it's 10 million years old. It's everything behind the white lettering. It's black. There's nothing in the universe to see because the little ripples in the universe haven't formed anything. But gravity is working on those little ripples and trying to make the first stars and the first galaxies in the universe. But hydrogen itself, when it's nice and cold, doesn't show much. It doesn't emit any light that we can see in the optical. But it turns out it does emit light we can see in the radio. And the reason is that protons and electrons have spin. They like to spin like a top. It's quantum mechanical version of that, so it's a little different. But they don't like to be pointed in the same direction. They like to be pointed like that. And so sometimes when they bang into each other, two atoms, one of them will get banged up and will look like this. And it wants desperately, well, not too desperately, it takes a long time, to go like that. And when it does it, a little photon, a little piece of light comes out, but it's a radio wave. It's not a light piece that you can see with your eye. So that means that cold, dark time of the universe, there should be radio waves coming out in all directions. But it's a long, long ways away. So what do? You have to build really big radio telescopes. And that's something we're doing in Australia, in Western Australia. We have a project that involves my own university and most of the universities of Australia, along with Harvard and MIT, and the Arizona State University. And this is a new modern telescope. Instead of being these great big radio dishes, what we can do now is we can use computers to go through and essentially make these things into little radio dishes. So instead of having to put them on a giant parabola like we used to, what you do is you go through and you say, well, the light here is going to arrive just a little bit before the light here, and we can mimic a telescope with a computer. The beautiful thing is building these giant dishes is really expensive. Throwing things out like this is much cheaper. And with computers getting bigger and bigger and bigger, we can make these telescopes bigger and bigger. This telescope is a prototype. It has 128 of these put together. So it's a reasonably good sized telescope, but it's only a sort of a forerunner to what we are trying to build in Australia and Southern Africa, known as the square kilometer array. That would be a square kilometer of radio dishes combined together. And so part of that will be born and built in Australia probably over the next 10 years. And it will allow us to look back to this epoch. We think this prototype might just catch a glimpse of that dark ages of the universe. And we can see if gravity is rearranging the hydrogen like we expect it to be. But this telescope is the one that will give us the big picture and look at it in detail.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Brian P. Schmidt, Distinguished Professor, Australian Research Council Laureate Fellow, and astrophysicist at the Australian National University Mount Stromlo Observatory and Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. His talk on The First Stars of the Universe was recorded at the University of Alaska Anchorage on August 25th.
So at some point, The Dark Ages end. We know that because we exist. And this is a computer simulation of the Dark Ages ending when the first stars appear and they start putting radiation out. And that radiation once again goes and rips the electron from its proton. And so the universe ends up producing a tiny little fog. It turns out the universe isn't very dense now. So although all of the electrons become separated from their protons in the universe, the actual ability for light to travel through it is still pretty good because the universe is so much bigger, less dense, and the electrons are so far apart. And so we can go through, hopefully, and start to test whether or not our physics models are right in the near future. So at some point, we expect the first stars to appear and the first galaxies to appear. Now that's a real picture of the early universe taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. And the most distant objects you see here, these tiny little splotches, we believe to be galaxies that are about 13 billion years in the past, roughly then 800 million years after the Big Bang. So with the modern telescope, we can look back that far. We can't, it turns out, see the oldest things in the universe. We'll talk about those in just a second. All right, so the thing that we expect to happen, we expect the first things in the universe to be big stars. So to understand what those big stars do, let's just understand the life cycle of a star like the Sun. So our Sun was formed 4.6 billion years ago in a cloud of dust and gas. Gravity caused that dust and gas to collapse down and form the Sun. It got hot, got dense, and the nuclear reactors started that could convert hydrogen into helium, same way the nuclear reactor worked in the early universe. Our Sun is going to burn for 10 billion years. It's 4.6 billion years through a 10 billion year life. Towards the end of its life, it's going to start running out of hydrogen as its fuel. And when it does that, it rearranges its nuclear reactor, and it turns out it becomes much, much brighter. And when it does that, it's going to become a giant star, a red giant, and it will go out to roughly the distance of the Earth. We haven't figured out how to destroy the planet ourselves. Four and a half billion years from now, the Sun is certainly going to do it for us. And so it does that for about 100 million years. The Earth is toast. And at some point, the Sun turns into this beautiful thing we call a planetary nebula. And in the very center, where most of the mass of the Sun is, that collapses down to a tiny little star called a white dwarf. If you're a big star, life's a little different. Big stars live fast and die young. They start off their lives just like the Sun, but they burn their fuel very quickly, a million times faster than the Sun. The fact that they're 10 times bigger, they have a 10 times larger fuel tank than the Sun, doesn't help them very much for living long because they're burning their fuel a billion times faster. So they live 100,000 times or thereabouts less long than our Sun. So they only last for 50 million years. So then they become a giant star, a red supergiant. If you can go out and look at in the winter, so not so much now, but of course it's not dark here, it doesn't matter, you can see the star Betelgeuse in the constellation Orion. It's the big red star in the constellation of Orion. There's also a blue star there. So the Rigel, the one star, is one of these, and Betelgeuse is one of these. It's near the end of its life. And sometime, maybe tonight, maybe 10,000 years from now, Betelgeuse is going to have worked through its nuclear reaction chain, making heavier and heavier elements to the point that it is able to convert sulfur to silicon, and then sulfur and silicon to iron. Now, when you get to iron, a problem occurs. In each of these nuclear reactions, when you put a bunch of helium together to make carbon, the carbon weighs a little less than the helium you made it out of. And that's because E equals mc squared of energy has gone out in the nuclear reaction. When you get to iron and you try to make cobalt or nickel, E equals mc squared is negative. You make something that is heavier. So you don't get any nuclear energy out. Rather, you get a nuclear refrigerator. And so these stars are producing these nuclear reactions. That produces heat, that produces pressure, and that pushes gravity out. So these stars are able to not turn into black holes simply because the nuclear reactions in them are producing the pressure that counteracts gravity. Suddenly, the core of it's made of iron. It's very dense. Iron gets created into nickel, into cobalt, but that takes away heat, takes away energy, takes away pressure. So the star starts to collapse because gravity is now stronger than the pressure. As it starts to collapse, well, more iron is created into cobalt and nickel, making things even colder and worse. And so you get a runaway. And this whole thing, shooting match, starts to collapse, and kaboom, you get a supernova. So the last supernova we've seen in the nearby universe was seen in the nearest satellite galaxy to our own Milky Way, the Large Magellanic Cloud. I can go out and I look at this almost every night before I go to bed because it's so beautiful. And it's a galaxy you can see from the southern sky that is literally the moon of the Milky Way. It's not a very big galaxy. It only has 10 billion stars like our sun in it, unlike the 100 billion stars that our Milky Way has. And in 1987, right before my 20th birthday, this little star, there's actually three stars at the arrow, became a big bright beacon. So the nice thing about bright beacons is you can see them. The other interesting thing about these is they produce all those elements: carbon, oxygen, iron. Remember, the Big Bang didn't produce any of those elements. And so what we expect is right after the Big Bang, the first stars in the universe will be formed. They only last for 50 or even 5 or 6 million years because they burn their fuel so quickly. They explode, you might be able to see them, and they produce all the elements that make life and the universe interesting. So we expect the first stars in the universe to end up forming things like this. They also form, as I said, all the elements. Now, when you go through and look at the calculations, you get a very interesting fingerprint from a supernova of how much stuff there is in the universe. So here we have light elements like hydrogen and helium, and here we have things like uranium and lead and other things. And this is how much stuff you expect to see in the universe from a supernova, and it turns out it looks almost exactly like how much stuff there is in the sun. If you predict how much iron there should be in the sun relative to hydrogen and helium, you get the right answer if you have the sun made up of several thousand supernovae over time. So over the 9 billion years from the time of the Big Bang to the time when the sun was formed, 1,000 or so supernovae contributed to make the sun have its elements. So how can we go back and see if this all happens? Well, one way is to really just look back to the dawning of the universe, not with radio waves as I showed you, but with optical light. And we need something really bright. So one of the first bright things that we've discovered in the universe were some objects called quasars. This is what a quasar looked like with the Hubble Space Telescope. It turns out it's more or less what it looked like with the optical telescopes that existed in 1964 when they were discovered by someone by the name of Martin Schmidt, not related to me. It turns out he used the position figured out in Australia with the Parkes telescope. Back in those days, you couldn't tell where radio sources were. This object was found in radio first. And they couldn't figure out where it was, and the Australian astronomers of the day had a very clever thought, which really upset their British counterparts, because the British counterparts did not think of this. The moon was going through this part, and so they watched it very carefully, and then the moon went in front of this object, so they knew the object was on the rim of the moon. Then they waited for the moon to go past it, and suddenly turned on again, and it knew it was on that rim of the moon. They knew where that was, told it right where it was. But Australia didn't have any large telescopes at the time in the optical. So I had to talk to the people at Caltech. They told him where to look, and they discovered this bright star had this funny little jet sticking out of it. We know now that these things occur in galaxies. So here's the Hubble Space Telescope, and you can see there's a galaxy there. But this thing is a giant black hole, a black hole a billion times bigger than our sun that is essentially taking on stuff, and as the stuff falls onto the black hole, it leaves huge amounts of energy behind. So these things are really bright. This thing is 30% of the way to the Big Bang and is bright enough to be seen in a small telescope. So we can use these things to go all the way back that we can. So we need to now know a little bit of something else about a hydrogen atom. A hydrogen atom that has its electron is typically in what we call its lowest energy state. But if a photon of exactly the right energy, it turns out to be in the ultraviolet, for those of you who understand the concept of wavelength, that's a way of measuring the color of light, it is 121.6 nanometers. And so if you have an exactly 121.6 nanometer ultraviolet piece of light, it will come in and change the state of the hydrogen atom. It will move that electron to a higher energy level. And it turns out that if you are a photon of exactly that energy, this atom, again, looks like a giant baseball bat. You're going to see it. There's no way to get past it. If you're just a little bluer or a little redder, then you can't see it at all. It's only at this very precise color that this reaction can occur. And so if we look at these distant black holes, which we can see a long ways away, we can imagine that every time we see an object between us, a little proto-galaxy, it's going to have hydrogen. And that hydrogen is going to absorb that ultraviolet photon. You also need to remember that as we look back further and further away, the universe is stretching. So the photons are stretching along. So every time we get to a galaxy, we're going to get a little niche out of the quasar's spectrum, its light of a specific color, and we can count how many galaxies are. So the galaxies, it turns out, if we look at them directly, are changing. These are galaxies 11 billion years ago. These are ones that are more like 7 or 8 billion years. And you can see the early galaxies are kind of messy train wrecks. And these galaxies are still kind of train wrecky compared to the beautiful spirals we have today, but galaxies are forming. So this is a way of getting an insight of how galaxies are changing over time. And here is a spectrum of a quasar. One is very nearby. This is the one I just showed you, 3C273, the first one identified. And you can see there's almost no notches in it. But this is what a similar quasar looks like back, and this would be roughly 11.5 billion years into the past. Each one of these little notches is a proto-galaxy. So in the nearby universe, not many galaxies. In the distant universe, lots. Why? Because the universe here is 3.62 times smaller than right now. That's how much the universe is stretched. And the volume or density of galaxies goes as the cube of that. So 3.6 to the third is a number like 80 or 90. And as you see 80 or 90 times more glitches. So we can actually use these quasars to study things back in time and see how the universe, sort of these galaxies, grew over time. If you go through and count quasars, you have a problem. This is the number of quasars back in time, and there's lots and lots and lots of them. 9 billion years ago, there were quasars everywhere. Our Milky Way was probably a quasar sometime in the past. It has a relatively modest 3 million solar mass black hole in its center. But then before that, there weren't very many. And when you get back to when the universe was quite young, 500 million years old, there's essentially no quasars left. But if we look at the most distant quasars we've yet discovered, they're very boring little red dots. Okay? So this is where the universe is stretched by a factor of 6.2. where the universe is stretched by a factor of 6.4. And when we look at these distant objects, and this is their spectra, when you get up here, you can see that there's no longer little notches in the spectrum. There's just no light getting through at all. And that's because the proto-galaxies are stacked up on top of each other very densely. The most distant quasar we've yet discovered is this one. And here's what it looks like. Here's its spectrum. The light has been stretched in the infrared. And then when you reach the edge, boom, nothing. No light is traveling through the universe in that ultraviolet piece. And so that's a way of saying that you're reaching the point of the dark ages, sort of when galaxies were stacked on top of each other and the universe was full of hydrogen rather than stars. Now, that's the most distant object. That is an object that had been stretched by a factor of 7.2. But there is something I study, an exploding star that is even brighter than these supermassive black holes. It turns out to be known as a gamma ray burst. They are, as I like to say, the largest bangs in the universe since the big one. And they're even brighter than quasars. And the reason they are is that we believe that they're a formation of a black hole, but not a big one, just a little one. But the difference is that as it collapses, this thing spins up, and it ends up shooting a jet of light. And occasionally that light will be focused right on the Earth. And so instead of spreading its light out all over the universe, it acts like a laser beam pointed right at us. Now, of course, most of these are not pointed at us, but occasionally they are. And when they are pointed at us, they're incredibly bright. And so they give us the opportunity of seeing things across the universe back in time. So this is the most distant one of these, and this is an object I worked on. The light of this object is stretched not by 7, but by 9.4 times. It's the most distant object we know of in the universe. We believe this is an exploding star that was forming a black hole. This is one of the first stars in the universe. So we can go back and we can look, in this case, 450 million years after the Big Bang. So we know already there that there were things in the universe. Now the hard part about this is these things only happen about once a year. And they last for about an hour. And so you have to be on your toes. You may have heard my phone earlier. That could have been a gamma ray burst going off, and I've just missed my next big discovery. But you guys are important to me, so. So these are very challenging, but they are something we can use now. Another way to do it, and as I said, I'm impatient, is to rather than build these big, big telescopes and look back in time, we can go through and see what's here, left as a fossil record of the universe. So the Milky Way, that's actually a picture of the Milky Way, taken from our vantage point with a satellite in the infrared. And if we zoom in the infrared, this is what the middle of the Milky Way looks like. You can just see, at a slightly higher resolution projector, you'll see there's 100 million stars in this one picture. So there are 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. And with a modern telescope, we can go through and look at each one individually and do a huge data mining exercise like the National Security Agency does on you every day. And so these previous work have gone in and they have isolated stars. And I'm going to show you the sense of the problem. Here's a picture of about 10% of the sky. And we're going to zoom in to a single star. And the star isn't particularly special. It turns out it had a very funny color that we can identify with a telescope. And that star, when you look at it and take a spectrum, and you look at its fingerprint, and I'm sorry this isn't a very good quality image, here is the fingerprint of all the elements for the sun. And you can see there's all sorts of stuff, because the sun has a lot of stuff in it. Here is a star that is 1,000 times less stuff in it than the sun. And you can see there's just a small little fingerprint here. And this is this star. It has a tiny amount of iron, 100,000, 300,000 times less iron in it than the sun. One of clearly the first stars. Well, but it still has iron in it. So in Australia, after having my observatory burned to the ground in 2003, I have started a program to go out and map the sky with a new telescope called SkyMapper. And it has a very large 268 million pixel digital photographic plate, about that big by that big. It's about $2.5 million worth of silicon on it, it turns out. And that is going through and literally doing a census of every star we can see in the sky, looking at the colors and identifying the ones that don't have much iron in it. And I'm proud to say that we have discovered our first star, and here it is. Here are the two stars that weren't the sun on the previous diagram, and here is this star. You can note it has no fingerprint of iron at all. It has a little bit of calcium, it has some carbon, but it is the first star we have ever discovered that has no iron in it. Now, it still has calcium in it, and calcium was not made in the Big Bang. So we think this is the second star. It is a star made from a single explosion. It gives us, sort of tells us what the first exploding stars were like. And when we analyze it, it's quite uncertain, and it's early days. This is in the middle of a publication at Nature, which they're sitting on it, telling us if they're going to take it. It looks like it was probably formed out of a star 60 times bigger than our sun that ended up producing a huge black hole that sucked up all the iron. And all it was able to get out was a little calcium, magnesium, and carbon. So we're beginning to get a fossil record. This is number one, but we expect to sift through several billion stars over the next 5 years. So we hope to be able to get a whole record, a whole lineage of what's going on in the universe. But we're also building new telescopes in the future. One is a program of which the Australian, my university in Australia, are again working with Harvard, with the Carnegie Institution, with University of Texas and Texas A&M, University of Chicago, and Korea to build a new generation of telescope that has 7 mirrors, and you can see how big it is relative to a semi-trailer. A huge new telescope that will allow us to look back further than we've ever been able to in the past, be able to look back to those first stars. And these telescopes have to be incredibly precisely manufactured. It is quite a technological challenge. Turns out also a financial challenge. It was a mistake trying to build these things in the middle of the global financial crisis, because although Australia has paid its bills, the United States has not, because it was all based on philanthropy. So we're hoping the stock market will continue to go up. But the mirrors we're already in the process of building. I went to the University of Arizona. Here is the University of Arizona Mirror Lab. That's mirror one. Here is mirror two. Mirror three will be started here in the next, I think it was actually started here yesterday. I was invited to go there, and I said, no, I need to be in Alaska. So this telescope is on its way. 2022 is when we hope to have it working. We're not the only ones doing this. It's quite fierce competition. The Europeans are building an even bigger telescope, a 39-meter telescope. And so this telescope should be able to, it's slightly different than ours. They work quite complementary together. And there's another telescope being built by Caltech and the University of California and several other countries. So our hope is these telescopes will all come together 10 years from now. But the real granddaddy of them all is the James Webb Space Telescope. The James Webb Space Telescope is the next generation Hubble Space Telescope. And because it's above the atmosphere, it has the ability to essentially see further than we can easily on the ground. These big telescopes can see small patches if we correct for the atmosphere, but the James Webb Space Telescope is above the atmosphere, which tends to glow in the infrared where we need to make observations of the early universe. So these are images of what the James Webb Space Telescope should look like, and we expect it to launch in 2018, assuming that they do not overrun their budget again. The program has had a great deal of problem managing its budget. But it will be an amazing telescope for astronomy. And it, too, is well on its way, and I'm going to finish with the future by showing you a couple-minute movie of James Webb Space Telescope being put together as I had a chance to start answering questions. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Brian P. Schmidt, Distinguished Professor, Australian Research Council Laureate Fellow, and astrophysicist at the Australian National University Mount Stromlo Observatory and Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. Following his talk on the first stars of the universe, Dr. Schmidt responded to some questions from the audience.
How do we know we're not getting a mix of things when we look at an object that is a couple billion years out? Quite conveniently, the universe isn't that crowded. And so we can see usually that it's a single object. And if we go through, and I showed you that image of the deepest image we've taken, there's still a lot of space between the things we see. And so occasionally they are a mixture of things. But 999 out of 1,000 times, they're not. And so we use that fact that most of the time, the universe is full of empty space, and we can use that to our advantage to isolate things. Yep. So that's a good idea. Is the universe like a fractal? Fractals, just for reminder, are things that repeat on smaller and smaller scales. And so if you look at them, it turns out they never become smooth. You can't take an average and say that's an average part of the universe, because there's always more and more information on large scales. So the best thing to do is to go out and test it. So last year, one of the students that I supervise went out and tested it. And the universe is not a fractal. It's very clearly not fractal. And so as near as I can tell, good idea, worthwhile testing, it's just not right. So the universe is smooth. The Big Bang Theory once again survives. All right, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Distinguished Professor, Australian Research Council Laureate Fellow, and astrophysicist at the Australian National University Mount Stromlo Observatory and Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics, Brian P. Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt was awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics long after he graduated from Bartlett High School in Anchorage. The University of Alaska Honors College hosted Dr. Schmidt's talk on the first stars of the universe at UAA. Special thanks to Kathleen McCoy, who recorded the presentation on August 25, 2013. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online anytime at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Platt. Thanks for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.